I really like tinkering. So it's like, oh, okay, if I try this thing, what's going to happen on the other side? Can you do your thing, open the door and be like, ha, it's what I thought, or whoa, it's not what I thought. Why is it that way?
Dr. Helen Tran takes her research in polymer chemistry seriously, but she also makes sure to bring some fun into her work wherever she can. In order for people of all backgrounds to appreciate and understand science, she says, communicating with excitement and joy is essential. In this season 4 episode of Bringing Chemistry to Life, we speak with another member of Chemical and Engineering News' 2022 Talented 12 about their work and trends in their field. I'm your host, Paolo Braiuca from Thermo Fisher Scientific. We began by asking Helen about her interest as a child and how she found her way to a career in science.
I didn't grow up thinking I wanted to do chemistry, right? I grew up in San Jose, California. My mom did middle school, my dad did high school, immigrants, didn't get a lot of exposure to science. And, you know, I was just going along, public school kid. And then, you know, I think where I lived, I got really lucky and I was able to go to college at a public school and the best public school in the US, Berkeley, California. And that's really kind of when I started becoming more interested in chemistry. You know, when I was younger, I had all these dreams of like being an artist, maybe a psychologist. And then I started college maybe wanting to do architecture because I had some math and some art. And because I didn't really have a lot of guidance in college, I didn't really know what I was doing. I sort of just took whatever classes everybody took. So, the science people, or the med school people. So I took, you know, physics, biology, and chemistry. And actually, I remember sitting in organic chemistry and thinking, oh man, I'm going to hate this class because everybody hates this class. But during that semester, I sort of realized organic chemistry is like architecture, but for molecules. And then I got really excited because there's this artistic side to me, like this idea of like putting things together and building them. And depending on how you build it or what building materials you use, you can get this thing that has emergent properties. As I progressed in my courses, I became more interested in synthesis because of this. But really, it was polymer chemistry that caught my eye, because this is where your project or your construction, it's not just one little house. You're doing a big building, right? So polymers are things that have repeating units. And there are a lot of, you can think about it as small molecules, a lot of them put together in a chain. And when these are put in a chain in different patterns or how the chains are connected, it really changes the property of these materials. And so it's a huge playground as a molecular architect to think about how to design things and get these new properties. And so that's my sort of career path, kind of coming from this sort of artistic side, not really knowing what to do, sort of being open to classes, and then kind of falling in love with chemistry in a sort of later stage in my life.
And almost by chance, right? You know, you said at the beginning, this would be disappointing. It is not to me. I'm kind of disappointed when I speak to these people who have like a sort of family history of being in science and, you know, follow their parents. That's kind of boring in a way. And it's reassuring to see that even for successful people, you know, sometimes things in life just happen. You know, chemistry kind of happened to you, right? You stumble across it.
Yeah, I actually didn't take AP chemistry when I was in high school. So it was like, oh, that's kind of funny. Like, you don't have to be taking AP chemistry. I actually would skip out of chemistry TAing in high school so that I could go to art class and do pottery. And I remember my chemistry professor being very disappointed in me. So maybe he's proud of me now.
how much do you think that you're sort of unusual path, right? You're kind of meeting science later in your education and, you know, having this more artistic instinct, right? Or being interested in arts and architecture has helped you and is helping you now, right? In your way of thinking or in even in the choices in your career.
First off, I just want to say I've met chemistry later in my life, but later was still very young, right? It's college. There are people who discover it much later. You can still discover a love for chemistry in your 30s or 40s, right?
Indeed.
I actually think the biggest thing art has helped me with my job is sort of how I frame myself and how I define success. As a faculty and as any young professional, you're constantly sort of comparing yourself with other people. I feel that this job could be, you know, overwhelming, but for me, art has sort of been the pathway to make me feel like a reminder that I'm on the right path and I'm doing this the way I want to do it and communicating the way I'd like to and what I think is most effective. And it's also my creative outlet. So it helps a lot with my mental journey as a professor.
And I know you are very active and this is very close to your heart because, you know, you do a lot for science communication, STEM. And, you know, if you don't mind, I'm going to go there later because I think it's sure. just about yeah. time to jump into your research. You know, you are, you mentioned it, you know, you work on polymers. You are maybe in a nutshell, a polymer chemist. Your research focus is on these bioelectronics or biocompatible electronics. But why don't you describe your research? Because you would do a much better job than if I tried.
Okay. I'm going to try to pitch my grand vision of like what I want. So it actually ties in with my group logo too, if you ever see it. So like for me, I'm really interested in thinking about how can we make electronics more harmonious with the body. So the first stage of that is thinking about how does the body work, right? Often you have these really complex functions from proteins and other things that are all happening inside our body. And to build these machines, they're quite basic building blocks like peptides. But when they come together, they have these emergent properties, right? So you have these simple building blocks, you put them together, and you get something new out of that property. In my group, we think about self-assembly a lot. How do we make these sequence-specific polymers similar to things like peptides? They're called peptoids. And can we design the right sequence or using the right building blocks that when we put them together, we can make something greater than its starting points? And then can we think about these materials when we're making them? Can we have them interact with a body in a way that is harmonious, so it doesn't elicit an immune response? Can it be soft and dynamic, the way that our bodies and organs and things are constantly moving, right? And then in the long term, one thing I really appreciate about our body is it's constantly regenerating. We're getting new layers of skin. Things are being recycled within our body and disposed of. So can we make these new devices inside our body or new types of electronics degrade, or can we get them to recycle?
So the way electronics interact with the bodies at the moment is fairly, fairly basic or fairly traditional. You know, the electronics that go in contact with the body aren't that different than the ones that, you know, live outside of it. We're still using mostly metals, right? Or there are some polymeric material. I'm sure they are advancing, but, you know, what you're really looking for is something completely, completely different.
I think there's quite a bit of advancement in biomaterials. And the key is, can we use what we learn from biomaterials and translate that to bioelectronic materials, right? So the types of electronics that we're interacting with our body inside and out is transforming right now. It's changing every day. And there's these beautiful examples already out there. And in my group, we're trying to push that envelope. We're not thinking about what can we make today. We're thinking about what can we make in 5 to 10 years. So we have to go back to the starting point and rethink the actual materials.
So what kind of chemicals you usually, what, you know, what's the chemical nature of the things that you develop? Because I'm assuming you mentioned peptides, but I'm assuming, you know, you need to have some sort of electroconductivity, right, in the material. So I'm envisioning these sort of multi-conjugated compounds, these sort of things. And you know, how do you meet the sort of biological needs of having a biocompatible materials, introducing flexibility, or, you know, there's a self-assembly concept that you mentioned. Feels like a very complex multivariate problem, because, you know, at the end of the day, you still need to preserve the sort of electronic properties of the material. Otherwise, it's completely pointless.
It's true. You have these multiple circles that are overlapping, and they each have their own design parameters, right? But I think it makes it an interesting challenge as a chemist. So can you design something that can fulfill property A, say self-assembly, property B, electronic conductivity, and property C, degradability, right? So that's what we do in our group. My main focus right now is thinking about organic electronic polymers. So we also think about some mixtures, so using some inorganic materials, things like metals and silicon. And this opens up a lot of questions, because there's multiple stages in to make this happen. I think if we use our existing electronics, we need to think about how to interface. And these sort of interfaces, we need to have the right gradients, we need to have the right ionic and electronic conduction of these materials, and mechanical properties. So in my group, we look at all the materials available. We think about polymers because we can design them in different ways. We think about mixing them so that we can control this gradient across inorganic and organic, as well as something soft and something hard. On the other end, we're also have to rethink about, can we make electronic devices that are a new concept? So not using the existing types of electronics that we have, like our phone. So we are inspired by biology and thinking about how that's done. So one of the beautiful examples in nature is bacterial nanowires. So these materials conduct electricity, or they're conducting. There's a little debate on how they conduct. I think there's some consensus, but anyways, it uses a different design. And so these bacterial nanowires also self-assemble. So it is possible to have these types of things because they're in nature. So can we become inspired and design something that's self-assembling in a similar way? We haven't figured it out yet. That's what we're doing in my group. So if you have ideas, let me know.
Well, you're asking the wrong person very clearly. You know, I would have asked you, but it's so when you're thinking about a new paradigm here, and you're thinking about, you know, a new way of pushing the envelope and thinking of an electronic device in a new way, are you really thinking about, you know, being able to create, you know, a transistor type of thing in you know, with a biological material? Because at the end of the day, that's what an electronic is, right? It's a series of logic gates. Yeah, you need to do some sort of computations, and it uses electronic charges in a semiconductor material in a normal electronics. I don't know how that could work in a biological system, but it's kind of interesting. I'm thinking as you speak about it, it's kind of developing in my mind.
That's the dream. I think a first starting point for us is really going back and just seeing, can we make sequence-specific polymers that are conducting and self-assemble into structures that resemble things in electronics? So I'm really excited about 2D materials, not necessarily 2D materials like graphene, though I am excited about those. But can we make self-assembling structures that are conductive, that are like a sheet of paper? Because this is the basis of a lot of electronics. Like, how do you make a transistor? They're often a series of layers on top of each other. So we take a step back. Can we even make a layer that is conductive? Can we make a layer that's semiconductive or serves as an insulator? That's our first step right now. How do we do that inside aqueous or biological conditions? Then once we get that, maybe that's when I'll get tenure. Then I'll think about how to bring these pieces together. And then can we start thinking higher level and putting these films together and constructing them in a way that can resemble electronic structures? And I think we have to move away from a, you know, flat planar system and think about dynamic electronic devices self-assembling into a transistor in solution. And can they function? They may not function exactly the same way, and they may not function as well if you use the same metrics, but these devices may be a really nice complement to existing electronics.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Bringing Chemistry to Life. I just wanted to steal 30 seconds from the interview to tell you about ChemDex, the new tool for organic chemists on thermofisher.com. If you run reactions for a living, or if you just have an interest in synthetic chemistry, give it a shot. It's full of useful information and a much faster way to find the products you need to run your reactions. You find it at thermofisher.com/chemdex. That is ChemDex. Check it out, it's free. And now, back to our conversation. This is really fundamental research, right? The way you describe it, and it's a properly grand vision. So it's very tricky, right? And it's very ambitious, which I like. But I'm assuming it's, you know, how do you pitch it? You know, well, how do you get your funding? You know, is there anything more applied, or is there any more concrete problem that maybe as a side project or as a sort of part of your grant scheme that you kind of help you get in there?
We definitely have more. Like we're a spectrum of fundamental to applied. I have some other projects that are like, oh, we're making this polymer elastomer so that we can put it on a robot so it has the right mechanical properties and stuff like that. I'm going to use this moment to rant a little bit that there needs to be more funding for fundamental research.
Do it. I would agree with you. Where...
Well, I mean... Well, there's so many rants about that. I guess I just want to say that because that really is, you know, if you want to make changes, you can with applied research. If you want to make transformational changes, you have to go back and look at the fundamentals. I also think fundamentals are a great way for training graduate students to think and dig deeper into concepts. And that's how you often can get inspired and come up with new ideas based on these fundamentals. Okay, I learned this fundamental property A in over here, but maybe I can apply it to this application over here. So that's really only possible if you have some knowledge of both. So in my group, we have a mixture of projects, some very fundamental and some much more on the applied side. So one project a graduate student of mine is working on and actually has really done a great job at Abby Clapperton is thinking about how to scale up the synthesis of sequence-specific peptoids so that it can be industrially relevant.
I'm assuming that usually you do it like with automatic synthesizers in the lab?
A mixture, yeah. So we have an automated microwave synthesizer that we can do this, and we're also thinking about batch scale reactions. She was able to sort of demonstrate that this can be done like grad school environment level, but it sets the stage for if this is a technology that other people are interested in, it would be really nice for batch reactors. So we're sort of on both ends. We have in Canada, we have this thing called NSERC Discovery Grant, and it's what funds my fundamental research. And then it's not enough, but
it's never enough.
Never enough. It could be enough. It could be enough. They really could just double it. Anyways. And then the other projects are really where I hope to seek industrial partnerships as well.
What would you say is your real motivation, your real, you know, driver for your work? Is it the fundamental challenge? You know, is this the scientific aspect? You know, the what you can discover? Or is it how your research can be applied to something real and perhaps changing people's life?
What brings me a lot of satisfaction day to day is seeing that is putting more energy into mentoring and helping younger people figure out what is the right career path for them and really enjoy and make the most of their PhD or master's. That's my day-to-day satisfaction in the job. But in terms of like why this job instead of a different job is because I think I'm really fascinated with the idea of like, if we just change the order of something or change the sequence, like basically design this new molecule, it leads to completely different properties. Like that is so powerful. I guess for some people that may be cooking, right? Everyone starts with the same stuff, but depending on how you cook it or what you do to it, you can have this like magnificent meal. So like for me, if you have a polymer sequence, but let's say I make it a pattern that's alternating instead of just one monomer, it can lead to these nanoscale properties, or it has these nanoscale dimensions that could be useful for lithography. That I find really fun. It's like puzzles, I guess. I really like tinkering. So it's like, oh, okay, if I try this thing, what's going to happen on the other side? Can you do your thing, open the door and be like, ha, it's what I thought, or whoa, it's not what I thought. Why is it that way? There's very few jobs where you can see that. And it's very rewarding because it's something you made or something you designed.
I really like you putting the fun in this, you know, because the way you describe it is quite beautiful.
I feel like everyone goes through an existential crisis of like, why am I here? Oh, yeah. What am I doing? What is it meaningful? And yeah. So being able to say, you know, people need satisfaction from their jobs. This is becoming more important to people, I think, especially the younger generations. And so reframing it as a potential career path to do that is something as an opportunity I see. It's something I think is an opportunity.
You know, it's to me, it's important. You know, people I work with, Ryan, and having fun at work and finding, you know, a meaning in you know, in having a good time, and you know, knowing that maybe you're doing something that makes sense. You know, even though you might not save the work what you did on that Wednesday afternoon. Mm. You know, that's fair enough.
For sure, most people are not doing that. Yeah.
I want to go back to the fun because this is really good and really powerful. And, you know, when I was looking at your website, you know, when you get into your scientific communication part or your involvement with STEM, I found it really fun that the spin you give it, at least on the website, you can tell this is important to you and you're enjoying it. Can you tell us a bit more about your involvement in this?
Sorry. So when I was a postdoc, I saw this call where you can be selected as one of the if-then ambassadors, AAAS if-then ambassadors. And the call was to highlight people who've done some outreach and representation of women in media. And so I applied. And I was a little surprised that I got it. So it was a good lesson to apply for things, even if you don't think you're super qualified, because you might be. And so as part of the program, they gave us a lot of opportunities to interact with students, as well as be on, you know, we took photographs and we can use them in any of our purposes, and museums would also use them for their purposes. Like I think my photo was used on the Girl Scout workbook and the AP chemistry workbook, actually, I think. But yeah, so it's I think it's something that has really motivated me to continue doing science communication to the general public. I really think my role has changed quite a bit because now I'm, you know, no longer a student, I'm getting older. So I have to rethink about how do I want to engage with the public now, right? I think I have some ideas and I'm putting some proposals in. So hopefully you'll see some cool exhibits in the future. And I'm now reaching a point really reimagining how I want to interact with the general public. So I'm excited about this next stage, and hopefully next time I can tell more about it.
This is really important to me. I like it a lot. I think we don't speak about science often enough. Science needs to be a bit more, right? The part of the of everybody's day to day. You know, there is this general skepticism in the world, which is wrong, and it stems from something. And probably one of the reasons is that historically the scientific community hasn't paid enough attention to communication to the broader audience,
there's no incentives,
right? Yeah, well, that's right.
Well, there's not a lot of incentives, so I think it's a multi-pronged problem. So not just the scientists, but like if there was more value placed on that somehow. But yeah, that's a whole different discussion, I guess.
It's a good point though, right? So what? How do you find the time for it? Is it really, you know, going back to, you know, your path and, you know, understanding the importance that the right communication and meeting the right people have had on you, and so you want to give back? Is that all?
I think that was true when I was a postdoc. I think since I've started my faculty position, I haven't done as much in my, well, I've done like podcasts. So I have to like reevaluate how I want to do my science communication. I guess it's just very different, right? I wasn't doing podcasts as a grad student, but now my science communication is like podcasts and like more talk based and stuff like that. So I don't know. I think it goes back to what I value and how I define success. And to me, success is being able to communicate my science and why the general public is funding our research, and get people excited about it. It's a high priority for me, and because that's how I define success. But as a professor and as many scientists, they're being pulled in so many different ways that I didn't understand when I was not in this profession. So you just have to prioritize things, and people prioritize some things, and I prioritize this.
There are a few scientific celebrities, though, and they play a role. Do you think we need more? Do you aspire to be one of them?
I think I need to push my research up to a level of credibility first. But I don't have strong desires to be a celebrity or anything like that. I don't know. I always think about, like, what do I want to get out of this? And one of the things is reaching communities and inspiring people so that they can bring their voice into science. So my family, I often think, like, I have one foot here and one foot in a very different community. So I often think about my nieces and nephews and like, how do I get people like them excited about science? And I think those sort of problems interest me more. They feel more meaningful.
It's beautiful. It caps it very nicely. You know, it's how you look at the deeper meaning in what you do, which, you know, makes you such a rounded person. It's beautiful to hear. As we get to the end of our chat, there's a way we always close with the same question. You know, it's very appropriate for you, particularly more than for most, I think. It's, you know, now that, you know, you have accomplished something and you have still a lot of in front of you, but, you know, you're probably in a good moment where you can stop and you know, look at someone that just starting their career. What would be your suggestion, your recommendation?
I think this is the same piece of advice that I give to anyone who's starting up their career. There's sort of two. One specific to a professor and one just broadly. Like, you need to define success for yourself. Like, figure out what success means. Does that mean getting that high-paying job, period? Does it mean interacting with the community, period, or some combination? You can't have it all, right? And so you need to figure out what combination would make you happy and what are the metrics to make you feel that you are successful. And that's important because everybody's going to be successful in their own ways, and you'll always, there will always be someone better at you at A, B, or C, right? So figuring out your metrics for success and what you will be happy for is something I think is very important, and it's something that I do a lot, as I mentioned earlier today. And then for those who want to become a professor, I really want to give words of encouragement for those who are doing a lot of service, a lot of mentoring, a lot of outreach. Those skills that you are gaining are incredibly important for being a professor. I do a lot of service, a lot of administrative tasks. I manage people. I figure out schedules. These are things that don't translate into metrics of success to get a professorship, but I think they are incredibly useful to be as a professor. So I think those are things that many people undervalue, but I highly value.
That was Helen Tran, assistant professor of chemistry at the University of Toronto, and one of the Chemical and Engineering News' Talented 12. Thanks for joining us for this Season 4 episode of Bringing Chemistry to Life, and keep an ear out for more. If you enjoyed this conversation, you're sure to enjoy Dr. Tran's book, video, podcast, and other content recommendations. Look in the episode notes on your podcast app for a URL where you can access these recommendations and register for a free Bringing Chemistry to Life t-shirt. This episode was produced by Sarah Briganti, Matt Ferris, and Matthew Stock.